Meeting will come to order.
Oh, okay. It doesn't look like that.
We had a little bit of trouble getting the system working, so we're starting just a few minutes late, but it gives people time. Is this a quorum? First of all, I'd just like to say to everyone who endured all the travel in the interim, those very early morning starts and not getting you back to your hotels until late at night, and Ms. Nash knows how to wring every penny out of travel budgets, and so using the max of the day to the max was something we always felt important. But we just so appreciate the involvement of so many committee members that you were willing to travel the state with us. We learned a great deal. It does make a difference. You are positively impressed with some, and you get to others and are surprised with some of the stories you hear. So it does affect the outcome of the bill. So thanks, everyone, for being part of that. Do we have a quorum? I think we're okay. Representative Ward, you were in attendance at the Thursday, April 11 meeting.
Chair, I will move the approval of the minutes.
Any additions or corrections to those minutes of April 11? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved. And we have some new committee staff. Gabrielle Sujen is the in the research department and assigned to this committee, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
For the minority caucus. And Max Hall is our page back there. Thank you so much for being with us. Could you tell us just a bit what school do you represent? Where are you in that process?
For 2 years, I'm planning on just getting my AA at Century College.
Century?
Yep.
You probably haven't chosen your field yet.
No, I'm taking political science.
Well, we hope it's a good experience for you.
Thank you again. Thanks.
Is that, do we have any more? I think we've got just those two staff, okay? Today is an informational hearing, and you have in your folder a spreadsheet and then the language of a bill that will be introduced today. I think we'll have a House file number. I'm the chief author, and there might be a little bit of confusion because it's not the bill that ultimately this committee will work on. This is the governor's bill, and as a courtesy, we always introduce that and advance that as well. And we have with us Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director, and Corinne Zewers, also from MMB, if they'd come to the table. And Corinne may look familiar to some of you. She was our fiscal analyst some years ago. Left here to go to MnDOT and now at MMB, so we've had long work experience and we know that she understands this area very well. I believe we're going to be joined later by Commissioner Showalter. He's delayed at another meeting. If there's another to the page, if we have another chair at the table when he comes so that he can join them up there. I'm not sure if there's a third one. So welcome to the committee, and I think we've got a PowerPoint in our folders as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation. Again, I'm Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director, and with me is Corinne Zewers, who is the coordinator for our capital budget process at MMB. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the governor's capital budget. Corinne will walk through it in more detail. Ask any questions you have. I'd like to welcome you all back to the Capitol and the start of your legislative session. And with such a fine weather we're having today, what could be better? So beginning with the total in the governor's capital budget, $986 million in general obligation and housing finance agency bonds. Total investment with this capital budget, including federal funds and local government match and private funds, is a $1.4 billion investment total in the capital infrastructure of our state. The governor's capital budget is a balanced approach. It emphasizes both higher education and economic development, with over 50% of the investments in his bill in these two areas. And these investments in economic development, higher education, transportation, and the state infrastructure positions Minnesota well for future growth. In this budget, he has addressed both high-priority state needs and specific concerns of local governments. The local projects, local needs are funded both through individual projects in the bill and statewide programs, such as the Roads and Bridges program at Department of Transportation. Just a bit of context in the budget. Just like you, the governor had over $2 billion in requests from state agencies that he poured through, as you have in the past months. $800,000 in requests from, or $800 million of requests from local units of government alone. $2.8 billion of asks overall. The recommendations that he is making in his budget recognize the need to invest both in state assets and resources as well as regional assets and resources. And finally, his current budget that he is proposing is within the state's debt management guidelines that we have. This slide here gives you a picture of how the dollars are invested throughout the state. Almost a third, 28%, are in statewide programs, and those are programs that any municipality or county can apply for, and those funds are typically distributed across the state. A little over a third are in Greater Minnesota, investments outstate, and about a third as well are in the seven-county metro area. On the screen now, or on this page in your presentation, is a breakdown of how the investments are laid out in terms of categories. Education and economic development make up 50% of his investments. Environment, state capital restoration, corrections, and human services are the next biggest areas. And with that, I think we will move into more detail on how the governor has made investments in his capital budget, and I'm going to turn this part of the presentation over to Corinne Zuers.
Madam Chair and members, again, I am Corinne Zuers, and I'm the capital budget coordinator for Minnesota Management and Budget. And I'll be going through the governor's recommendations based on the policy area and then also providing some examples of projects that he's funded in his bill. The first area that I'll be going through is the education area. The governor has recommended $265 million in projects for education. This includes funding for both higher education as well as the E-12 education system in the state. And the $265 million represents approximately 27% of his budget. In terms of the governor's funding for E-12 education, he is recommending $32 million in projects. This includes funding for early childhood education, as well as funding for the Minnesota State Academies in Faribault, the Perpich Center for Arts Education in the West Metro, and also funding for the Red Lake School District in Northwest Minnesota.
And members, this is the area, E-12, that that I suspect we maybe know less about past history and something about why this portion of the bill is smaller than higher education. You will note on Tuesday, March 4th, we're having a joint hearing with the Education Finance Committee, and we're looking jointly with them at the requests, and there will be a little bit of history about how some of this has evolved. So we felt this was worth spending a little bit of time on.
Madam Chair and members, moving on to the higher education portion of the governor's budget, the governor is recommending $233 million for higher education and workforce development. I think it's important to note that that number does not include the user financing that both the University of Minnesota and MinSKU contribute to those projects. Moving on to the University of Minnesota more specifically, the governor is recommending $119 million in general obligation bonds for the University of Minnesota. This includes $40 million in funds for asset preservation, as well as funding for three other more specific projects. For the University of Minnesota projects, the numbers are the $57 million for the Tate Science and Teaching Building, the $10 million for the Crookston Wellness Center, and the $12 million for the research labs are the state's share of the project, so that's two-thirds of the project costs. As an example, with the Tate Laboratory of Physics, recommendation that the governor has made. The total project cost for that building is $85 million. The university would be funding $28 million of that with bonds that they issued through user financing. And the pictures here on the left, you will see the Tate Laboratory of Physics as it is today, and then on the right, as the university envisions the project. For the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system, the governor is recommending $114 million in general obligation bonds. This includes $40 million for asset preservation. As you'll notice, that number is the same as what the governor recommended for the University of Minnesota for asset preservation. Sure. And he is also recommending an additional $74 million for projects at 17 campuses across the state. The largest of those projects is the construction of a new science education center at Metro State University. That project is a $36 million project and is pictured here and located in St. Paul. The second largest area of the governor's budget is the economic development policy area. The governor is recommending $232 million for economic development projects. That represents approximately 24% of his budget. The economic development area includes funding for both statewide programs as well as funding for regional projects. The statewide programs include funding for housing and also programs to expand businesses across the state. And then we have listed a number of the regional projects here. The regional projects comprise $170 million of his budget, and the statewide programs comprise $62 million of his budget. Just to provide some additional information on the business expansion programs that the governor is recommending funding for. There are three programs: the Greater Minnesota Business Development Infrastructure Grant Program, the Redevelopment Grant Program, and the Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program that are administered solely through DEED. Those programs all require at least a 50% match for the capital costs and have various purposes for the projects that are funded through those programs. The last of those programs is the Transportation Economic Development Program, which is a program that's administered jointly through DEED and the Department of Transportation. The governor's recommending $5 million for that program. And the picture to the left is a project that was funded in Windham previously through that program, in which it used both trunk highway funds and general obligation bonds in order to promote business expansion of a manufacturer that uses or that manufactures sprayers and also fertilizer equipment. The third largest area of the governor's budget is the natural resource, environment, and agriculture area. The governor includes $151 million in funding for this policy area, and this represents about 15% of his budget. This includes funding for the DNR, Pollution Control Agency, Minnesota Zoo, and the Public Facilities Authority, as well as local projects that fall within these jurisdictions. Approximately half of the natural resources, environment, and agriculture area are for funding new infrastructure, such as purchasing land, constructing new facilities that don't exist today. One example of this is the Lewis and Clark Water Project in southwest Minnesota. The other half of the funding is to maintain, improve, and reconstruct current infrastructure, such as the two projects that are listed here. These are two projects that the DNR would possibly consider funding for underneath or within the governor's budget, and there are many examples of this that could be funded within the governor's bill. The next area of the governor's budget is the Corrections and Human Services area. The governor is recommending $122 million for Corrections and Human Services. A majority of this funding is for specific projects, with $14 million for asset preservation. And I'll be going through two of the larger projects. The first is the construction of the first phase at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter. The governor's recommending $56 million for this project this year to address safety and security issues at the facility, including addressing issues such as narrow sight lines or narrow stairways, poor sight lines, and split levels within the facility. And you can see a couple of examples here that the department has provided. This project also, the department will be requesting $47.5 million for this project in the 2016 cycle. So this is a two-phase project.
We have a question. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it was in the DNR budget, the Lewis and Clark Water Project. We did a match to that many years ago, didn't we? Didn't we do our state, Madam Chair, didn't we do our state share many years ago?
Ms. Ebers?
Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, we did have an appropriation back in, I believe it was in possibly 2006 or 2008 for the Lewis and Clark Watershed Project that did represent the state share. In terms of the federal funding for that project, the federal funding has not materialized, and so the governor is recommending that the state move forward with that project.
Representative Mahoney.
So the feds promised a match and they didn't come up with it?
Ms. Zebers?
Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, they have not fully appropriated the funds for the project yet.
Follow up?
So we're replacing federal money, Madam Chair?
Representative Swidzinski.
Great precedent to set.
Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of going to the corrections and human services portion, is the fence project around the Shakopee Women's Prison in this?
Ms. Ebers?
Madam Chair and members, yes, that project is in the governor's bill.
Thank you.
Representative Gunther?
Madam Chairman, if the feds haven't paid it, but they might pay it. If they do pay it, does that mean the money does return to the state capital investment budget somehow? Or what does that mean?
Ms. Zebras?
Madam Chair and Representative Gunther, we have received information that looks like if the state did provide funding for the project that we would be reimbursed.
Could we get a copy of that communication? Follow-up?
Not fine.
Okay. Okay, continue.
Madam Chair and members, moving on to the second largest project within the Corrections and Human Services budget, the governor is recommending funding for the St. Cloud Correctional Facility to also address safety and security issues within that facility. The project at St. Cloud will include construction of a new health services unit, a new intake unit, warehouse, and loading dock. The picture that's shown here shows one of the issues that will be addressed, which is an officer in an unsecured location. Other issues include crowding in the health services unit as well as the intake unit. The next policy area that I'll be going through is the transportation and transit area, in which the governor is recommending $78 million in funding for this policy area. This includes $70 million in general obligation bonds, as well as $8 million in trunk highway fund cash. Over half of the governor's recommendation is for the construction and reconstruction of local bridges and local roads. Other projects within the transportation and transit area include funding for Greater Minnesota Transit, ports, rail, and safe routes to schools, as well as funding for projects within the metro area for transit, regional airports, and then funding for two Department of Transportation truck stations. In terms of the funding for Metro Transit, there are two projects, main projects, that are recommended in the governor's bill. One is for the arterial A line that runs along Snelling Avenue. The governor is recommending $10 million for that project, and that will complete funding for the Snelling arterial A line. The second project that I wanted to highlight was the work that the governor is recommending for the Metro Orange Line, the Lake Street Station. The $7 million that he's recommending is for the preliminary work for the Lake Street Station. That's a $53 million project to complete the station, which is also a part of a $150 million transit access project within that corridor. And the $150 million will be comprised of work through Hennepin County, the Department of Transportation, as well as the Metropolitan Council. And that project is also a part of an even larger project, which is the Orange Line project, which is a $212 million project that runs from the Burnsville Transit Station up to the 5th Street Station along the 35W corridor. The last area of the budget that I wanted to cover was the Veterans and Military Affairs policy area. The governor is recommending $12 million for this policy area, including $8 million for the Department of Military Affairs and $4 million for Veterans Affairs. Most of the work for both of these agencies is related to asset preservation projects, as well as renovations at their current facilities. One example where they will be doing some expansion work is at the Brooklyn Park Armory. The total estimated project cost for this project is $10.7 million, and there are two sources of funds, one federal funding of $9.4 million, and the state share would be $1.2 million.
We pursued that with military affairs, and maybe we can share that communication with you, but it sounded like part that $9 million was somewhat unsure, and that the only thing they could absolutely guarantee was a one-to-one match. I don't know if they had communicated that to you as well.
Madam Chair and members, I believe the total project cost is the $9.4 million, so we can talk with them a little bit more on the sources for that. And then lastly, the governor is recommending $4 million for Veterans Affairs. This includes $1.5 million for asset preservation, $700,000 for stabilizing and waterproofing the deep tunnels in Minneapolis, which is pictured on the bottom, and then $1.8 million for renovations at the Laverne and Silver Bay Veterans Homes. And one of the rooms at Laverne is pictured above. And with that,
and members, just an update on that. You may recall in last year's very small bill, we did $18 million for the Minneapolis home, again, hoping that would match federal funding. Federal funding has not been forthcoming at this point. We thought we were waiting in August, and we were waiting in December, and we were waiting in January, and at this point, we're not in the first 19 states. I think we're number 21, so that hasn't been accomplished yet.
Madam Chair, that concludes our summary. We're happy to answer any additional questions. I know there are many state agency representatives here as well to answer more detailed questions.
We wanted to, staff just reference, just in terms of the language, some areas that were new language that we thought we should at least take a look at so that members understand. Lines 124 to 22. The last sentence of Section 1 is new. It says that asset preservation, HEAP or natural resources asset preservation appropriations must not be used for projects that can be financed in a reasonable time frame under the statutes authorizing state energy financing program or guaranteed energy savings finance program. My assumption is you want that money to be used first, and only if that can't be done in a timely way that they would use asset preservation. Is that the point?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The governor is interested in encouraging agencies to use those programs at the Department of Commerce first, and if those cannot help fund asset preservation projects, then to use bonding proceeds for that.
And then lines 12.3 to 12.10 on the dam renovation and removal, the current statute, I think, allows money not needed for a project completed may be used for any other project in the section. The writer says that Section 16A, 69 doesn't apply, and money from one project under contract that is not needed may be used for another dam project. This seems to say that this section has been interpreted to prevent the unused amounts from grants awarded from dam appropriations from being used for other dam projects, even though the riders have said the money is for the program. So we're wondering what dam projects have not been funded because of how this section works or has been interpreted. Are there issues with other grant programs, or why do we have slightly different?
Madam Chair, I'm going to use a call for help and see if DNR wants to add any assistance in that.
And maybe we're making too big a deal, but whenever we see new language, we just think we might as well clarify. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kent Lacusmo, I'm the Director of Capital Investment for DNR. And as far as the dam safety program appropriations in the past, we've used those for multiple projects, and if one ends, and they haven't been line item appropriated for dollar amounts, so we've used the funds to work off of the priority list that's provided to the legislature, and the language has worked. I'm not sure if we need this language or not. I mean, that's something for discussion.
This didn't come from any problem with how it works or has been interpreted, the new?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so, no.
Okay. All right. Yes, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Zuers, or just wondering, the current budget is within the state's debt management guidelines. Sometimes those guidelines have changed a little bit. If you just review for us what the current guidelines are, please.
Ms. Evers?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have three debt guidelines. The first is that total tax-supported principal outstanding, meaning on bonds that we have. So the total principal outstanding for bonds that we have issued not exceed 3.25% of state personal income. And as of November forecast, November 2013, we were at 2.79%, so we were under that guideline. The second guideline is that principal outstanding, both for debt issued and debt authorized, not exceed 6% of personal income. And as of the November forecast, we are at 4.28%, so well under that guideline as well. The last guideline has to do with how the timing of our debt maturing. So no less than 40% of GO debt mature within 5 years, and no less than 70% within 10 years. And we were right at the 40 and 70% guidelines in November. We will be issuing a new debt capacity forecast tomorrow with the state economic and budget forecast.
Follow up?
Another question, if you will indulge me, Madam Chair. Under the Public Facilities Authority, $67+ million, I've had a long-standing concern about WIF and other water projects in the state, and wondering if Mr. Freeman could comment on the adequacy of this number for his projects.
He is here.
35.
Mr. Freeman, welcome to the committee. Did you hear the question?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jeff Freeman, Director of the Public Facilities Authority. The governor's recommendations include for Public Facilities Authority include $12 million as state match for our revolving loan funds, drinking water and wastewater, to match federal grants, and that's the amount we needed for that.
Do you want to reference that federal match, the amount?
That provides 20%, the required 20% of the federal grants, and for estimated federal grants in FY 15 and 16. So we always get the state match ahead, so we're able to draw those federal funds immediately when they're available. And then secondly, the Wastewater Infrastructure Fund, the WIF program, the governor recommended $20 million for that. Those funds go to projects based on affordability criteria. They're either packaged with the low-interest loan funds, or we use those to match funds with USDA Rural Development that also provides grants and loans for small rural communities. So those funds go to projects as they're ready to proceed. We don't award funds until the project's ready to go to construction, and we follow the priority list. I think many of you are familiar with the priority list. We coordinate the funding, as I said, with other agencies and stretch those dollars as far as we can. Those the $20 million should be sufficient for the needs that we're aware of for 2014 construction.
Senator Erdahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Freeman. I just wanted to make sure that you felt you were receiving adequate funding under this because, again, these are important projects to many of our particularly smaller communities in Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a damn question for Mr. Locksmore. He got away before I was able, Mr. Representative Erdahl got in there before me as he was leaving, so that's fine, that's good.
So,
and,
Mr. Locksmore, if you could.
Maybe Ms. Locksmore. The dam question, the dam language intrigues me because we in my district we now have an issue with a local dam that we have. So, you know, we talked about the language, and I wasn't clear. Can you tell us where the language came from? I mean, you know, we talked about the language, but where did it come from?
Mr. Locke.
Madam Chair and Representative Ward, I think in the past this language has been in various bills when there have been individual line item appropriations listed. If the program funding is just the $4 million for the dam safety and renovation program, I don't believe that this language would be needed. But it depends on the final language.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for Ms. Ewers. Just kind of looking at the House File 207, which was kind of our the majority position, at least for the position on the bill last session, we were at about 79.7 for Department of Transportation. That includes a lot of local roads and bridges. I see that the governor's proposal is significantly lower at 53. Representative Hausman and I were meeting yesterday with the Minnesota Townships Association and really stressed the importance of investing in roads across the state of Minnesota and the really difficult condition that they are in and the importance that they have in economic development and vitality in small greater Minnesota towns and regional centers, and wondering what that position would be from the investment from that. Is that adequate, and how much of a priority does that reflect from the overall budget of the bill?
And does one of you want to handle that, or do you want to have MnDOT come forward? Or
Madam Chair, I'm happy to have MnDOT say anything. I would just start by saying that there were a lot of competing priorities. $2.8 billion requests, less than $1 billion bonding bill. What the governor has included in his bonding bill reflects what he thinks are the highest priorities and the best balance among all those competing requests. So unless DOT would like to...
Do you have a follow-up for 15, or would you like to hear from the department?
I see the department shaking their head no, so
okay.
I'll take that as a answer. And just kind of following up on the overall debt capacity guidelines, if we could just kind of walk through. You walked through the three guidelines that we use, and I think you did a nice job of describing how we monitor that, and we'll find out a little bit more tomorrow about what will be our credit card limit for moving forward with the state. Can you talk about the differences between how appropriation bonds are scored against our debt capacity and how GO bonds are scored against our debt capacity, and how, what are some examples that you might have of financing that we have that's not GO finance but appropriation finance, and how that's getting considered to figure out how much money we can borrow to build stuff?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Dean, our debt capacity encompasses all bonding authorizations and bond issues, and so it includes general obligation bonds, trunk highway bonds, housing appropriation bonds, as well as just regular appropriation bonds. So, for example, the housing infrastructure investment that the governor is making in this budget will be housing appropriation bonds as opposed to general obligation bonds, but both of those are calculated in the debt capacity guidelines. The Viking Stadium was an appropriation bond issue as well, and that will be reflected in these guidelines as well. So the guidelines encompass all debt.
Madam Chair, and one of the important differences between the two is that one requires a supermajority of votes at 81 votes in the House, and the other requires a simple majority, but yet both are scored against our debt capacity and our borrowing. Have we changed the way that we approach which projects have to require a supermajority at 81 votes and which projects require a simple majority? You brought up some examples that we have used in the past requiring a simple majority. I noticed that the Senate office building that's being proposed is being passed with no appropriation limit and required only a simple majority with basically a blank check for that project, but yet that will be scored against our borrowing capacity just like any other project. Is there any change in the governor's policy or the state's policy for how we decide which projects require 81 votes and which projects require a simple majority of votes for moving forward? So, for example, could the DNR just decide that they want to build stuff and lease it from themselves with an appropriation bond to escape the supermajority of 81 votes because it's easier to do than to pursue within the bonding committee or the GO process that we use here?
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I believe the number of votes that are required are in the purview either of the legislature or is identified within the state constitution. It's not a policy decision of the governor how many votes should be required.
Well, the GO bonding would be a constitutional issue, the 81 votes.
And
what you're asking is, when do we decide when it's an appropriation bond? The piece that I would add to his, why we're increasingly concerned about that is higher debt, higher cost debt, and yet it can be passed with a simple majority. Some of us have talked about advising you to rethink those guidelines to say, should we perhaps be measuring appropriation bonds or separating them out and saying we're going to allow a smaller percentage for the appropriation bonds than we do GO bonds and trunk highway bonds because that's a higher cost debt. I mean, that's another angle to what you're...
Yeah, it is, Representative Hausman, more expensive debt, as Representative Hausman correctly points out, and also a policy shift that I don't think it's probably a good idea to have a simple majority decide when we don't need a supermajority. That's probably a bad policy shift for moving forward. So when you say it's a legislative decision and not a leadership decision at a higher level, I think that that gives me a little bit of concern for moving forward if we just need a simple majority to skate around a supermajority decision for down the road.
And the commissioner has joined us. Welcome. And do you want to handle that one? Or
sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting me up. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. My apologies for getting here late, but I know that Budget Director
Kelly. You got here for the tough
and Kearney, exactly. I have it all under control. On the appropriation bonds, I think we agree that appropriation bonds should be a very limited tool in the sort of the debt sort of arsenal, or the way that we fund projects. It has been a very limited tool. It's been really only in a couple of instances where the legislature's authorized those appropriation bonds. And I think we all need to grow up around what are those financial management guidelines that limit it. You know, to Representative Dean's point, though, it isn't really a strictly a governor's issue. We can put policies together, but if appropriation bonds are authorized by the legislature, I think we both branches need to have some policies around when and how limited circumstances those bonds are appropriate, because they are higher cost. They are, in many ways, a credit. You know, it makes it easier to access credit, and that may not always be the way we want to do it. We put around general obligation bonds a fairly strict process, and I think we'll want to make sure our guidelines and our processes support that.
Any more?
No.
Okay. Representative Clark has stepped away. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I wanted to pick up on the comment about the overall bonding, but Commissioner, when you said that the appropriation bonds were a limited tool, you may have been talking about the number of instances, but what comes to my mind is that, well, we were in the minority and protested, but the tobacco bonds, mm-hmm. that was a huge incurring of debt, and as my understanding would count against our debt limit as well. So I think we could put that on the table.
That was
because,
sort of the first direction.
Yeah, I spoke strongly against that in committee and on the House floor because of the debt we were incurring, and it was a high cost way of financing state government. We weren't in control at the time, but that was what the will of the majority was. But I do have a question, and I think I know the answer, but I'd like it clarified, Madam Chair. When the U of M has bonding authority, Met Council has bonding authority, how is that debt calculated? Is that in our total over? Is that considered, from our perspective, a part of the total bonding cap, if you will? And I'm not talking, Madam Chair, about when we pick up the debt service, but if they issue the bonds.
They issue the bonds.
And if they're picking up the debt service, does that count in our debt limit?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner?
Representative, the debt limits are trying to capture the state's debt obligations, and so to the extent that there's another issuer that's issuing those bonds, they do not count. Those examples are outside of the state's debt calculation. The recent Destination Medical Center, to the extent that the Rochester area issues bonds, those aren't part of the state's debt calculations for our guidelines. That being said, you know, when the University of Minnesota did the TCF Bank Stadium, as an example, or the biosciences, they were using state appropriations and basically monetizing that with their own bonding capacity. So the rating agencies do track it, but it doesn't count necessarily directly against our debt limits that we're talking about here.
Yeah, Madam Chair, then that...
Oh, excuse me, Madam Chair, and I went one step too far. On the appropriation bonds where we sent it through, Corinne is correcting me, that is incorporated into the state's over our arching debt numbers. Because those are bonds that basically are being, although they're issued by the University of Minnesota, the debt service, at least for a portion of those, is coming from the state of Minnesota.
Okay, Madam Chair, that's where I was headed next, because some projects at the university are user financed, at least a percentage. And how would that be calculated
in when it's user financed, and they use a variety of tools. Sometimes it's gifts that are used to offset the user financing. Other times it's just out of their general revenue. But I'm interested in how that kind of thing would be calculated as we look at what our total overall...
The user financing.
You know, if they're using their O&M, Madam Chair, I would assume that that would maybe come on our side of the ledger. But sometimes they're getting gifts, and sometimes they're using other sources of revenue. Tuition is a part of it, and how that's calculated in our overall debt.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, and we can all sort of want to address this, but the simple matter is our debt capacity is tracking the bonds that we issue. So in this instance where Minsky has some user financing, whether it's coming from gifts, from other revenue sources, the bonds that are issued on behalf of Minsky are included in these debt calculations. The University of Minnesota, on the other hand, they offer debt as well, and they are in those user finance issues. Those are separate. When they are, in fact, sole-sourced from the university's revenues.
Mr. Roloff was behind. Did you want to speak to it, too? We saw you move, and we were just...
Commissioner picked up the example.
Did you have
no, that, that
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really think this is a nice start for us, and I appreciate a lot of the projects that are in here. Having toured with the rest of the group all summer, you know, you just really understand more the depth and breadth of problems and projects across the state, and I've really appreciated that opportunity to be able to do that. And I think Representative Dean or Swazinski mentioned the roads and bridges issue. And I hope we, as a committee, can really take what the governor has started with and add to it, because it is one of the greatest assets we need to protect and grow in this state, and not just roads and bridges. You know, there's roads and bridges, but there's also rail. And I know the governor touched on that, but seems to be staying away from rail a little bit this year. And again, I ask the committee to, you know, as we move ahead, to start thinking about that a little bit and connecting our regional centers to the Twin Cities area and vice versa, which is maybe even more important to rural Minnesota. Representative Clark asked me a question, and I'm not sure this is what she was going to ask, but I know one of the concerns, we serve on the Childhood Obesity Task Force, that we've talked about quite a bit, is the Safe Routes to School, and I think there's $2 million in there for that. We'd like to see that bumped up, I think, a little bit, and I'll try to, you know, twist the arm here on the committee to do a little bit better on that, but appreciated that the governor put that in there. And the only real, if I could say, complaint that I want to mention is in the higher education Minsky and U of M priorities list, particularly the Minsky caught my eye. While the legislature and the governor generally does a pretty good list of follow, you know, going down the list of priorities and taking them in the order that the institutions have ranked them, I noticed a glaring leap over the regional centers this year in those Minsky projects, and was really disappointed to see that. So I just mentioned that. It is noted, not just by myself, but I know the Mankato and St. Cloud area and one other that came up in higher ed yesterday, that those were noted, that we were leapfrogged and left out of the governor's bill completely. So I mentioned that here so that they know that I know, and also that the committee can anticipate some requests of looking at that Minsky budget a little more closely. Thank you.
And I can sympathize with the governor and his staff as he tried to put this together, because we know how hard it is to include everything and still keep that number down. We're discovering that ourselves. And Representative Ward, I know, would agree with you on some of the transportation projects, airports and such. Is it to this point, Representative Mahoney? Otherwise,
well,
Representative Davis.
Everyone else seems to be saying they want more money.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Showalter. Representative Carlson kind of piqued my interest when we're talking about various costs of bonds and so forth. And I kind of need a refreshing history lesson here just a little bit. What governor signed the defeasance of the tobacco bons into law?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Governor Dayton.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, that said, the issue of appropriation bonds has been around for a number of years. That wasn't the first instance of appropriation bonds by any stretch. You go back to TCF Bank Stadium and other instances.
We're going to, we can come back to questions, but we had a couple of people who had asked to testify, and so if we could have the three people at the table make room for, we'll first ask Abby Rydick, Association of Minnesota Counties. Representative Clark, we'll come back to your question. We'll just have the testimony, and then we'll come back to questions. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you. My name is Abby Bryduck. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I think Jim Waffler was going to come up with from the Transportation Alliance.
But Mr. Waffler?
Too. Anyway, I'll get going. I think we probably have the same comments to share, but we just wanted to thank the governor for his inclusion of the bridge bonding amount and also the TED nod to the TED program, which we think is a very valuable program. And we appreciate the inclusion of some local road improvement dollars as well. However, you could probably expect that we're going to say that we'd like to see a little bit more in that amount. I believe MnDOT had recommended upward toward $100 million. We're also working with Representative Norton, and she's carrying our local road improvement bill, bonding bill, for a request of $75 million this year. Since we didn't get some money last year, we'd like to see a little bit more than $10 million. You know, we also know that a transportation bill, comprehensive transportation finance bill this year seems to have long odds of passing. And if that doesn't happen, we may be 2, 3, 4 years out of getting some new money. So we think that putting some bonding dollars in local roads especially is critically important. We saw an investment in the Corridors of Commerce program last year, about $300 million. But as you all know, you know, we have a statewide system, and our residents don't always know when they're on a state road or a local road, and we need to keep the integrity of that entire system as we move forward. I also want to just give some context. You know, a $10 million bonding program for local road improvement is split between the state or between the counties, cities, and the township systems, and this year we also may include the small cities of under 5,000 in that pot. So that would be, you know, we try to split it evenly, so that would be about $2 million, $2.5 million per system, depending on the roads that we're looking at. That could be, for example, for the county system, maybe 2 to 3 miles of you know, repavement or reconstruction in our entire state. So it really, you know, the capital intensive nature of transportation, that $10 million just really doesn't go far. I know in the past there's been a hesitancy to really beef up that local road program to continue to put pressure on having a sustainable statewide solution, but it wouldn't hurt, I promise. We'll still put a lot of pressure on having a big...
And Ms. Bryduck, I know one of the things that has changed, I can recall, I've been here long enough to remember, I am blanking on his name, rural Minnesota House member who chaired capital investment, and what he said was, all you have to do to pass a bonding bill is put in local bridge money. And I have to tell you, the politics of bonding bills have apparently changed because that doesn't work anymore. I think we'd be if we had the sense that was going to be true again. Henry Callis.
Yeah,
Henry Callis was the. Oh, you were just sending me the note.
No, while I was going to just chime in that's who it was, yeah. But he was very interested. He had one time had chaired the transportation committee, so that was a high interest area of his.
Were you finished with your question?
Briefly, I just wanted to also mention that we're concerned about the lack of money put towards the Bowser Wetland Replacement Program. This is something that I know the governor, I believe, is in support of, but it apparently was an oversight. We're still going to work on on that program. This is a big deal for the county engineers. They think they're not the right people to be able to do this, the wetland mitigation, and that Bowser is. We've got a great program set up, so we'd like to continue to see that funded.
That's definitely on our radar screen.
Good.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Waffler. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Waffler, and I'm representing the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. And we wanted to just make a couple of comments on the governor's capital budget, particularly regarding the local bridge and the local road improvement program. We're happy to see the governor address both of these issues, and the bridge program is being funded at almost more or less the historic levels it's been funded in the past. The Alliance recommended $75 million this year for the bridge program. We have to recognize there's been dramatic improvement in addressing the needs of our bridge program in Minnesota following the 2008 funding bill. However, there are still quite a few deficient bridges in Minnesota that either need improvement or outright replacement. But the main thing I wanted to focus on here briefly is the local road improvement program. We'd like to see that funded at a much higher level. The Alliance this year has recommended $100 million for what we think is a vital program in Minnesota for the road system. The money that would go to local units of government help fund all those local road projects that don't receive any direct state aid, they don't receive any federal aid or any other kinds of funds. They rely, the only options local governments have are property taxes or delaying or canceling the proposed projects. And we think the program, this program, can help relieve a lot of pressure on local government budgets. I wanted to particularly say that with the road deterioration problem are facing now and will be facing in the next couple of months with this historic winter has put even greater stress on local units of government as they are going to have to try to repair all of the damage that's been done over this winter. Anyone who had to drive on any local road this morning knows exactly what I'm talking about. And we haven't even gotten to the freeze-thaw cycle of March when the severe deterioration is really going to occur. Notwithstanding this horrid winter we've been suffering through, the demand for this program has already been well demonstrated. The last $10 million that was allocated for this program could only serve a tiny fraction of the proposals submitted by local units of government. So we hope you can find a way to add to that program this year, because of all the years I can think of, this is the year when it would do the most good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. We have any questions of those testifiers? We have Ron Harnack from the Red River Watershed Management Board.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Welcome
for
the committee.
Record, my name is Ron Harnack, representing the Red River Watershed Management Board and the communities in the Red River Valley. And historically, the state of Minnesota has been a great participant in helping with flood damage reduction of the communities, not only in the Red River Valley, but also statewide. And we note that the governor has not appropriated any money for that program at this point in time. And
I will say that at his press conference, he did reference that, and he said there was a reason. In that very small bill last year, that was the one item that did move forward, and he, I think he did acknowledge that.
Yes, he did. Yes. And I guess what I would like to emphasize for the committee as you go forward with your deliberations is that the flood damage reduction program has been very, very significant, helping communities throughout the state deal with their flood risk. And a lot of these communities without this kind of funding are basically going to die on the vine. And we've put a tremendous amount of effort into a number of these projects that a strong appropriation again this year would bring to completion another 9 or 10 projects, not only in the Red River Valley, but a few scattered throughout the state. And so we would encourage the committee to seriously consider how they could fund, and that probably is in the range, we think the sweet spot's about $25 million that would complete those communities. I believe Mr. Lacosmo may have provided the committee with a spreadsheet like he typically does each year. We don't generally line item individual communities or projects for funding, and I think there's a real advantage to that, If you look at the history of the flood damage reduction program, there are very little, if any, dollars that get carried over. And so there's the flexibility to fund those that really have an urgent need at a given point in time and can spend the dollars. By a recent example is federal funding became available for the city of Roseau. And in order to move that forward, they needed to provide, I think, $3 to $4 million of state's commitment to that by sometime in April, or that project would probably lose its federal leveraging. So I think that flexibility is important to maintain, and would certainly encourage the committee to give this some serious consideration. For every dollar of prevention, we save $4 of flood fight and flood recovery costs, not to speak of the kind of the mental anguish that goes along with having to suffer through significant flood events. One other area that I would like to just mention is the RIM Reserve Program. That has been a very successful program in dealing with water quality and also matching up with some federal funds and providing some leverage for the natural resource enhancement components of some of our multi-purpose flood damage reduction programs.
And until the Farm Bill passed, we didn't know if there was going to be federal matching fund, but after the passage, we do see that there is, again, matching federal money.
Yes, and I think it's interesting the new federal farm program provides some kind of improves the way some of these programs are going to be delivered, and so we're hoping that the rules that the USDA develops gives us enhanced access to those dollars. We really appreciate the committee visiting North Ottawa. That is one of our star projects that we believe shows really significant flood damage reduction benefits, but also other water quality and certainly migratory waterfowl benefits for the state of Minnesota. And we're seeing a number of those additional projects that are moving forward, and we hope there is available resources to help with that. Lastly, I think the counties did hit on it. Some of our local governments in the Red River Valley wanted to emphasize the importance of the wetland road mitigation program, and Madam Chair, you did speak to that already. So I appreciate the opportunity, and look forward to working with you as we move forward.
And Mr. Lacasmo did give us that spreadsheet. If you're interested, we can certainly give that to all committee members. I don't know if there's an interest in seeing and looking for.
I would like to see it.
Okay, we've got an updated. We'll send it out just so for any of you who might be interested.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Amanda Duer, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Amanda Duer, and I'm here representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And while our 85 member cities throughout Greater Minnesota are pleased that the governor included support for the Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program in his proposal, we feel that a funding level of $5 million does not reflect either the demonstrated success of this economic development tool or the demand that is out there for the program funding. The BDPI grant program is administered by deed. Greater Minnesota cities and counties can apply for grants for up to 50% of the public infrastructure needed to expand economic development, create or retain jobs, or increase the tax base. Examples of eligible infrastructure projects include sewers, water supply system, utility extensions, streets, wastewater treatment systems, and stormwater management systems. These projects can be used to support the following type of businesses: manufacturing, technology, warehousing and distribution, research and development, agriculture processing, or industrial park development. The BDPI program has a real record of success. Since it was first passed in 2003, 107 cities from Greater Minnesota have received grants to support 172 economic development projects. The program has helped create 3,125 jobs and retain 4,052 jobs. This program also has a great return on investment. The $49.1 million that's been appropriated by the legislature has leveraged more than $142 million in total investments. Historically, the BDPI program has received wide bipartisan support in the bonding bill. Governor Pawlenty would include the program in his bonding recommendations, and the final appropriations during his administration ranged from $6.1 to $10 million. And also in the 2011 and 2012 bonding bills during the Dayton administration, the program was also funded. The CGMC has proposed a bill, House File 2059, which is chief authored by Representative Jay McNamer and is co-authored by a bipartisan contingent of 20 representatives, which would provide $25 million for the BDPI grant program. And the CGMC is recommending this level of appropriation for two reasons. First, the program balance is nearly depleted, and there are many projects for which many cities would like to apply for BDPI program funding. I just sent out a quick message to EDAs and cities across the state and got lots of response. Cities like St. Michael, Windham, Laverne, Winsted, Pelican Rapids, there's projects that are out there ready to go. Second, the CGMC is recommending an increase in the maximum grant amount that's available to cities from $1 to $2 million so that cities can get assistance for larger scale infrastructure needs that are needed to support economic development. So those are the two reasons that we are requesting $25 million. The CGMC hopes that the House Capital Investment Committee will continue the long-standing bipartisan tradition of supporting the BDPI grant program, which is one of Greater Minnesota's best economic development tools. We also encourage the committee to fund the program at a higher level than the governor's initial recommendation, as we have recommended in our legislation. Thank you.
And I just can't help but observe that we often have separate bills co-authored, but you don't have to answer this. But for the record, I do wonder how many of those 20 co-authors then will be prepared to vote for a bonding bill that includes that. This is the big question when we get a challenging number before us. So just it's easy to co-author bills. It's another thing to actually help it happen. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is what I was actually raised my hand earlier to talk about more money. I'll probably start a firestorm here, but you know, significant parts of our budget go to Greater Minnesota for rural economic development. My budget last year of $100 million will be going out to Greater Minnesota, and we actually put $6 million worth of cash, which makes it much simpler for Deed to fund these projects, because when we do it with bonding, it has to have a public ownership piece to it. We also did a tremendous amount of money in TED, or Transportation Economic Development. But I know that even with the dollars that we put into these programs last year that are almost all rural economic development, I want everyone to know, because my phone rang off the hook this summer saying that we had abandoned Greater Minnesota on its economic development. And uncharacteristically, I bit my tongue. almost to the point of blood coming out. We have done more for Greater Minnesota in the last bill and with the previous chair, Representative Gunther. We're not altogether that far off on what we try to do with economic development. But with the Greater Minnesota Business Development Grant, I know that they have in the queue right now $10 million worth of projects that they could do. And I know, I'm not entirely sure on the transportation part, but I know there is a need for that also. And that improves a lot of intersections, I guess is the word I'm trying to find. Intersections so that trucks and businesses can get their employees and their products in and out of their particular facilities. And that has, both of these have been funded at great levels lately. But for every time we fund them, there seems to be, it's kind of like quack grass. Once you pull one, no matter how many you pull, you get a whole bunch more growing up. So these are really good projects for Greater Minnesota, and we should fund them. But I certainly wish my phone would stop ringing with complaints that we've abandoned them.
So if I heard you say $100 million from the last year's bill, is that able to be, do we actually have projects and towns and amounts, or I just didn't know if we could share that with the committee?
Working on that.
Okay. Thank you. Continue?
I was finished, but I will agree with Representative Mahoney that there is a great deal of demand for the BDPI grant program, and it is a very successful tool. If you speak to any of the city administrators, EDA directors who have used it, they will highlight its effectiveness.
And just to clarify, the business development public infrastructure goes only to Greater Minnesota. Transportation economic development redevelopment grants and innovative business development infrastructure go both to Greater Minnesota and the seven county metro area. Is that correct? You qualify for those three as well.
Correct. But the business development public infrastructure grant has a wider range of uses. You know, besides just the streets and transportation uses, can also be used for sewer, water, utility, other, you know, needed infrastructure to support businesses.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you know, I certainly do appreciate the work that Representative Gunther and Representative Mahoney have done over the years in trying to provide some assistance for Greater Minnesota. But coincidentally, just yesterday, I looked at some figures that I think emphasize the needs that we still do have. The rate of recovery from the recent economic recession is much greater in the seven county metro area than it is in the rest of the state. You're doing a lot better in the metro area in recovering from the from the recession than Greater Minnesota is, and so these programs that you're referencing are important, and you know, we need to continue and do as well as we can with them.
No further questions to this testifier, Rick Cardenas, Advocating Change Together. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Houseman, and members of the committee. I'm Rick Cardenas. I'm the co-director at Advocating Change Together. And we have a project called Remembering with Dignity, which is our restoration of cemeteries throughout the state at the various regional treatment centers. I'm here to note that the governor did not include us in the budget. And over the years, however, the bonding committee has been pretty forthcoming with helping us continue this project. Last year, I think we were in that failed bonding bill for $195,000, and the bill we put in, 558, I believe, was for $1 million. We didn't want to come to the bonding committee for a lousy 195. The way people are talking here now, it's kind of a little bit, what am I doing here? I wanted to make sure that I gave information on where we are. We have 5,000 left out of the 13,000 that we began restoring with the name, number, birth date, and death date to replace just those numbers that are presently on those 5,000 that are left. So we have a great big place in Fergus Falls with over 3,000 on Mark Grave, and we continue to do Rochester and some around Hastings. But if we could maintain the program over the years, it It helps us in doing the research and also pass through those for those markers. So.
And members, if you don't know about this background, these are all people who have died in state institutions, and the only thing that identified them was this concrete pillar in the ground with a number. That was it. And so this group has just been gradually identifying and putting more permanent markers. We actually, that 195,000 was a real number. We know there's, you can only accomplish so much in a year, and so we've been gradually working away at that number. But it's a noble activity that has been carried out here, and we thank you for your work.
Well, and thank you to the bonding committee. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. No questions. We have Gordon Hoff is not in the room, right? But Sheila Vaney from Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members.
Welcome.
For the record, Sheila Vaney with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And I wanted to briefly follow up on the previous comments regarding the Reinvest in Minnesota Reserve Program and the absence of funding for it in the governor's bonding proposal. The Soil and Water Conservation Districts across the state implement that easement program at the local level, and there is a significant backlog of interested landowners who are waiting for bonding funds in order to perform the wetland restorations associated with these easements. And as was mentioned earlier, we do now have a federal farm bill in place that provides the leveraging funds of $1.4 federal dollars for every state bonding dollar that goes into a given project. So there's significant resources that are available to be brought into the state to help finance these wetland restorations for water quality and flood prevention. I believe there's $9.4 million just in applications that are sitting on the desk at the Board of Water and Soil Resources ready to go. So we know that we have at least $9.4 million in current pending applications, and if we project that over the biennium, we have at least another $20 million in interest across the state. So we're very interested in seeing some funding for this program in a bonding package this session, and we look forward to working with all of you.
And we had one wonderful visit in Representative Poppy's district for any of you who were there that day to talk about all of the benefits that come out of this work. I mean, one of those certainly is flood prevention, holding water on the land, but also creating habitat. There's a sports writer in the newspaper who decries the loss of wetlands and habitat, and the rim work has been part of what we've gradually been doing to restore that. So I think multiple benefits, four that I can recall. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Benny, thank you for the work that all soil and water conservation districts do throughout the state of Minnesota. In particular, you know, the one that's in my area up in Crow Wing County has done multiple projects, even things like, runoff from pavement in big resorts to try to purify the water and make sure that that's not happening. And so it's a statewide organization that really does lots of great work for water quality. Like just as in reference to Representative Erdahl's point about the business development infrastructure grants for Greater Minnesota, this is also a area that in Greater Minnesota, lots of good water quality work is done, and so the need is great, very, very great. I know in my area, there's Representative Mahoney talked about the number of projects in the queue for that business development grant, the Greater Minnesota grant, and same thing is true with the soil water conservation districts. And so I would just agree that there's a need there, and that we need to look at that. So thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We didn't invite public testimony, but you can tell we've had some requests, and we would certainly, if there was anyone else in the audience who didn't get their names to us but intended to, that you would be welcome to come forward as well. Representative Clark, you were out of the room earlier when we had questions.
Yes, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask either the representative.
Maybe we're back to the governor's staff. Is that it?
Yes.
Okay.
And the question has to do with the affordable housing portion of the legislation and the bonding for housing. The governor has recommended a total of $50 million for the both for the infrastructure housing and for public housing rehabilitation. And I know that the original request from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency was for double that amount. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how that got cut in half. And the reason I'm raising that issue is that this is just such an incredible statewide need. We have had our public housing in particular all over the state, the housing that houses a lot of our senior citizens and persons with disabilities throughout the whole state. The need is something, as I recall, something like $400 million. And, you know, I think the what's left in this bill is $10 million. So I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how this, why this got cut down to half.
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, like I said earlier, $2.8 billion of requests and only less than $1 billion bonding bill. So only one in every $3 asked for got funded. Difficult decisions. The governor had to balance as best he could. I think he would have liked to have a much larger bonding bill, but kept it where he was at. I think from a statistical perspective, the housing area probably did better in that they got 50% of their quest instead of 33%. But it's difficult decisions. I'm sure you'll wrestle with them yourselves.
Madam Chair, yeah, I realize there are difficult decisions. This is something that's been put off and put off and put off. Just for committee's edification, you know, during the ever since really the 80s, housing has been cut and cut and cut at the federal level and also at the state level. And finally, last year, we started putting some additional money back into the actual housing programs. This is statewide. This is not any parochial issue at all. Every single one of us has buildings in our district that house these elderly and seniors, for example, seniors and persons with disabilities that are falling apart. And once you lose that housing, once we lose that housing, we can't afford to rebuild it at the level of what it was built before. So I don't know, maybe I guess I just want to highlight the fact that even when it was the amount that was recommended by the agency and by the advocates, that was way under, you know, what's really needed. But it was an important first step. And so it's really, this is a part of the bonding bill that creates a lot of jobs, a lot of good jobs for people building trades, folks all throughout the whole community. And I guess I maybe just want to highlight that. I don't know if MHFA wants to respond to this at all, but I do know that there's been an incredible unity among folks who are dealing with these issues, both in the advocacy community and in our agency, to try to, you know, really get some funding into this portion of the budget. So I'm looking forward to, Madam Chair, I think your bill has additional funding in it, but I'm just concerned about what the governor was thinking. Again, both a jobs creation bill and just saving housing that's going to be lost unless we invest in it now.
And we will talk more about this issue in a few weeks when the bill is before the committee. There are so many parts of this bill that are interrelated, and the one connection I always make on the issue of housing is University of Minnesota Research. Half of the people who are homeless are under 20 years old, and the University of Minnesota did research on these children who are homeless or highly mobile. And what they discovered, and I'll distribute this in a few weeks to the committee, what they discovered is by the time that child has reached fifth grade and they've been homeless or highly mobile, what they are achieving at the level of a second grader who lives in stable housing. That's the achievement gap. That's the contribution that being homeless or highly mobile makes to the achievement gap. One of many things we'll talk about in a few weeks. But I know the heart of the governor was such that this amount that he includes is unprecedented, I think, for a bonding bill. I don't know what our history is, but we hope we can continue to prioritize this. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not sure who...
Was it to...
Well, it's to housing, you know, and I'm not sure if the governor's staff can answer this or Representative Clark can answer this, but I'm just wondering how much we would reduce the need for public housing if there was a $2.25 an hour raise to the minimum wage. I'm also kind of wondering if we ever have any numbers on the working poor that are not able to... You know, not able to put a roof over the house without state assistance, and we're basically subsidizing corporations that refuse to pay a living wage. So I'm not sure if the state can answer that question, or Representative Clark, or it's just our moral compass.
Probably an editorial comment.
Oh, an editorial? Me? Editorialize?
Madam Chair, to that point, I just want to say, I that really isn't a flippant point. It's actually something I've thought quite a bit about, and I do hope as we move forward that the housing folks and the governor and this committee grapple with how those things do interplay. And if we do one, maybe the need for the housing will drop, and we need to just think very carefully about that. And I don't have an answer, and I'm not proposing to, but I just think we need to weigh that. It is something serious.
Representative Mahoney to the point, and then Representative Clark.
Well, Madam Chair, and you know, and as the Economic Development Chair, one of the things that drives me, I've not been able to overcome this, but the state subsidizes through its economic development a lot of jobs that do not pay a living wage and do force the state to pick up the housing and the federal government to pick up SNAP dollars for companies that we do workforce training for, we do infrastructure changes or additions for, and frankly it's a little frustrating to put this kind of money into businesses across the state. And all the professional meeting people here should go back to their clients and tell them that at a certain point the state needs to say, pay a living wage or don't come to the state and ask for help. Because we're a little tired of taxpayers subsidizing your business in this particular way. So we have a bill somewhere that says you have to, in order to get state subsidy, you have to pay a $14-15 hour wage. And at some point, if the message doesn't get across to businesses, I think that might become a state law, and I'd love to see a legislator vote against somebody getting a job for $14.50 an hour.
Did you have another comment?
Madam Chair,
Representative Dean and Representative Gunn.
Madam Chair, I was going to say there has been a lot some very specific study on what wages are required in order to afford the housing throughout all the parts of our state. And I can just tell you in my own neighborhood, in my own district, to rent a two-bedroom house or apartment, it's $16.25 an hour would be required. That, you know, most of the people in my community don't get paid that kind of a wage. And I can tell you that Jobs Now as an organization has done a lot of research on this. You can go to their website, and for every single one of our districts, you can look at what it would take to afford housing, what kind of wage it would take to be able to afford the housing in that district. So I really recommend folks do that. They've done a lot of really good work on that. And Representative Mahoney is right. We have had passed laws that require that corporate subsidies respond with a decent wage, living wage. Some of it is not enforced totally, but I think we could look at that again.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is Capital Investment Committee, and we're talking about building stuff, and I have a sneaky suspicion that the minimum wage bill will be coming up this year, so I think there will be plenty of opportunities to debate about that. But before I check out, I just want to say thanks to all of the agency staff who are here today and for all the work that you did in putting together the governor's bill, and particularly MMB. And Commissioner Showalter, to congratulate you on a great hire with Ms. Sewers. With all the work that we have to do around here, we always I'm always astounded at how the great staff that we have, both in the House and in the agencies, and you wonder, where are we going to get people to replace these folks when they move on, and we get young Mr. Lee over here that just comes out of nowhere, who I hope is going to stick around for 35 or 40 years. So.
That was your contract.
So I just want to say thanks to everybody who's will be working on the bill and who's already started working on the bill for going ahead, so thank you.
And Mr. Lee was a page for this committee and now is our fiscal analyst.
That's right.
He's red.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up, Representative Mahoney, about minimum wage. And I have been an advocate for the last 3 or 4 years for workforce housing, and I want that to be considered synonymous with affordable housing, because a person making $12 an hour can't afford to build a house. And however, a couple may be able to do it, but it's a hard job, and I really believe that. As far as minimum wage is concerned, that's a debate for another time. I know affordable wage, there have been 3 or 4 states that have used that, and none of them have done it successfully. Yeah. However, I would like to point out that the wage that we give money through deed, either in rule or in law, is already there at a higher wage than the proposed minimum wages.
And we are our time is up, but Dan Larson has asked to speak very, but we've heard about the issue I think you want to talk about, we'll give a minute.
Madam Chair and members, thanks for allowing me to speak on this topic. I just wanted to get on record. Dan Larson, Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus. Two primary concerns. Looking at the local road improvement funding and the level of that the governor has recommended, we feel is too low. This is a program that that was created in 2002, if you will, as the major projects program for Greater Minnesota. These are the programs that the funding formula just won't reach to. The little projects that that we think of as economic development. If you need a 10-ton road from the rail line to the co-op, and your funding formula won't reach it, this is the program that we look to. And it's a good program that's been underfunded since implementation in 2002, and we'd like to see it get a little more attention. The second piece is we'd like to also see funding for the wetland replacement program. If Bowser doesn't have the funding to replace impacts to road projects, that falls back on the county taxpayers, and either fund that program or eliminate it, quite frankly. So that's it. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. I don't see any further questions. Our next meeting is joint with Education Finance. It's in room 200. They've identified some, but Representative Gunther, I think they're also going to add the Jackson Library bill to that agenda. I don't know what the I don't know what their arrangement is for all of that, but I think they're adding that one as well. So, pardon me?
When is that?
Tuesday, March 4th is our next one. Meeting is adjourned.